Hello and welcome to episode 80 of the Rights Honourable podcast. My name is Jimmy and as per usual I'm joined by Jazza. Jazza, how are you?
Hey, great. Have checked that the mic's working properly this time.
Yeah.
That's why we didn't have an episode last week. Sorry everyone.
Nice of you to point that out to start us off with. We're joined by Mark Chapman this week of the Pirate Party. Mark, why don't you just start by telling people who you are and what it is you stand for?
I feel like you need to give people more softball like introduction. What do you stand for? What do you believe is right and wrong?
Well, firstly, thank you for having me. Softballing that one back. So, fundamentally, the Pirate Party is, as I see it, a party of freedom. Mm-hmm. Freedom in all areas, both online and offline. We kind of originated from the Swedish party in 2006 that developed out of the Pirate Bay court case that was going on there. Since then, there have been pirate parties developing around Europe, mm-hmm. Most successfully in Iceland recently, where they got a good 10 seats in their parliament. As pirates in the UK, we kind of take those core principles, those underlying philosophy, and are trying to apply it in a British perspective.
Okay. So you're standing as a parliamentary candidate in Vauxhall, is that right?
Yes. So the Pirate Party, we've got 10 candidates across the country. I'm standing in Vauxhall. We've got others in Manchester, Sheffield, Wales, Bournemouth, Norwich.
Mm-hmm. What would you say is like the, like you said, the overarching idea was freedom and born out of the Pirate Bay case. Mm-hmm. What kind of is the one-liner message for the Pirate Party that the Pirate Party wants to get across? If you have one. You can use two sentences if you like.
We need a digital politics for a digital age. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of comes back to everything that we talk about. So we actually understand technology. So we see what has happened on just recently with the NHS and the ransomware approach to it, and the total lack of any technological understanding by politicians that put stuff in place or try and respond to it and talk about it. Mm-hmm. We see with both Amber Rudd and previously Theresa May when she was Home Secretary trying to say, oh, well, you need a backdoor to encryption, mm-hmm, so that, mm-hmm, we can get into it. And we're like, no, you clearly have no understanding how this stuff actually works. Mm. That is like asking the police, telling everyone to put a front door key under their doormat, mm-hmm, and saying, it's fine, we'll only use it if we really need to, and no one else will use it, honest. Mm. You know, you just don't understand how this stuff works.
I'm going to start using that analogy because it's really useful, because trying to describe like encryption to old people...
Difficult.
Yeah, hard.
Difficult.
Also, just to anyone, to be completely...
It's funny you mentioned the backdoor thing, actually, because James Comey, the FBI, mm-hmm, director who was fired this week a couple of years ago, was one of those advocates for we need backdoors in Silicon Valley products. The first topic we'll be covering is his firing, kind of the parallels between this and Nixon's administration and Watergate and that sort of thing. Jazza, what's your kind of rough view of things?
What's my rough view, yeah, of American democracy being tested to its limits? So this is super, super interesting, mm, because it is essentially a megalomaniac man who's never had to answer to shareholders and has run his own business and has been able to just fire people in the past, now being put in a system that does not allow for the man at the top of the pyramid to be able to do whatever he wants. Mm-hmm. And apparently, I quite like all of the gossip that surrounds everything that happens in the White House at the moment, mm-hmm, and all of the leaks that happen. Apparently he's been losing his shit regularly in the White House because he watches a lot of cable news,
yeah,
and he's really annoyed that the Russia story, quote unquote,
got out.
That it isn't going away. Like, mm, I think he kind of expected people to be bored of it by now. And Comey is, as the director of, the former director of the FBI, was the man who instigated this investigation while there was still the campaign trail at the end of last year.
Yeah.
And Trump has tried to, and Trump's team have tried to kind of say that they did this for Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. So Comey is the guy who may have cost Hillary Clinton the election by saying that they were opening an investigation into her emails again. It was 2016's October surprise.
Yeah.
And Trump is saying that that conduct where Comey kind of ended up taking part in politics is a reason that he should be fired and that he's incompetent.
Indeed. Before you go on, we probably should say what other topics we're planning on doing.
Oh, okay, yeah. Cool. So
before we go in too hard on that, the Labour... So other than the firing of the FBI director, we're also going to be discussing Labour's leaked manifesto, which I think was leaked to The Mirror and then was widely publicised online. The Mail and the Telegraph went in pretty hard on it and said it was going to take...
It's going to ruin Britain.
...to the 1970s, was the decade quoted. You've read the manifesto, I'm assuming, or the outline of it.
I've read the outline,
right.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts as a rival party?
In some ways, I think that a genius bit of spin doctory to leak it, because the only way anyone would ever bother reading a manifesto, in some ways.
That's definitely true.
It kind of, it actually got people talking about it in a way that they wouldn't do otherwise, I think. There are some bits in there that seem to be sensible. There are some bits in there that I would strongly disagree with.
Right. But it's not quite as out there as maybe some people have publicised.
I wouldn't have thought so, no. I mean, it's, there are elements to which the Mail or the Telegraph kind of were always going to take the Corbyn line of back to the '70s, pretty much whatever it had said.
Right. Yeah.
In some senses, because that's kind of the attitude that they're going with about Corbyn. Full stop.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there are some things in there, but actually, if you compare it to the 1983 manifesto, for example, from Labour, which was had much more in it about nuclear disarmament, for example.
Right. Yeah.
There are much more things that you could be concerned about in certain ways.
Okay, so we're going to be covering that, and then we're going to be talking more broadly about the Pirate Party and their election platform. But to circle back to James Comey, what do you think is actually the main point of this story? You mentioned the kind of Trump's previous experience of being held to account as a...
him not having any.
Well, yeah, not being held to account. I guess the underlying kind of theme to all of this is Trump eventually going to be impeached and actually tossed out of the White House in the long term? And that's why people are excited about it, right?
Yeah, so a lot of people have been drawing, I think kind of hysterically, the line between and the comparisons between this and the firing of Comey and the Saturday Night Massacre, which happened in 73, a year before Nixon was impeached.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, Nixon ended up trying to fire the person that was investigating the Watergate tapes. But the guys, he wasn't able to fire himself, and so he ended up going down the chain of command, making people resign if they didn't fire the guy who was actually meant to be running this investigation. And then a year later, Nixon then ended up getting impeached and had to leave the presidency. Or resigned the presidency, or something, whatever the actual technicality is. But people are very excited about the fact that this might be the first kind of part of Trump's eventual impeachment, because Russia run things.
Do you think it's likely he'll get thrown out of office for this?
I don't think it's likely he'll get thrown out of office for this.
Right. But maybe it's
possible. For the firing of Comey.
The Russia thing more broadly, do you think?
I struggle to see the sufficient amount of evidence being there to enable that to happen. It's one of the things that the US has is quite high. To get thrown out of office as president, there's a pretty high barrier. Clinton didn't manage it despite everything with Lewinsky going on and
Monica.
So firstly, the House of Representatives have to vote by majority to impeach someone, which is effectively charging them with misuse of public office. And then two-thirds of the Senate have to vote to get you to throw out the president from the White House, right?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah.
And bear in mind that there are Republican majorities there. So it would be his own side, effectively, that would be looking to get rid of Trump. And in, from a purely naked political perspective, if the Republicans got rid of Trump, who are they going to replace him with?
I mean, Mike Pence
becomes the vice president in the short term.
So Pence becomes president in the short term, but actually is that... Would they rather that, or would they rather have a Trump that they can get Republican stuff through, but has plausible deniability while wasn't ever really one of ours?
Right, okay.
Going forward.
Impeachment also only ever really tends to happen when there are incredibly low opinion ratings among the public. And although, like we all know very well, that Trump is the most unpopular president in this period of taking office, nobody knew is liking him. His core base still haven't changed their opinion of him, and so that makes something like impeachment a lot harder.
Well, because you then have an issue. The difficulty with impeachment is you also then have, well, what is it that it needs to be seen to be cleaner than clean.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it'll be like, oh, establishment, Dems, they're out to get the person that was, you know, standing up for the little guy.
Okay.
Now, I don't think that's the case at all, but it would be...
Donald Trump, the little guy.
But it's very... It would be... You know, you want to be really careful about not giving that impression.
Right.
Because otherwise you end up with a situation where you have a nation that is very divided and very difficult to heal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worry that the Democrats are a little bit too trigger happy with this stuff at the moment as well, in terms of like claiming victories and really having their goal set on getting this guy out of office. I worry at least about this being so public, because it really kind of defines them as a party, as the anti-Trump party, rather than the Democrats having actually any kind of a policy basis and policy-based disagreements with Trump. And then their whole narrative ends up being getting him out of office, and that feels very undemocratic. Even if the impeachment, as you said, is clean and has weight behind it.
Surely impeachments, by their very nature, are quite squalid things, though. Like when the when Bill Clinton was facing impeachment, it was widely seen as the Monica Lewinsky scandal was just an excuse to turf him out of office, and he hadn't really done anything substantially wrong. And there's still, I mean, for instance, when you watch like the Bill Maher show, I'm just thinking of when he talks about that, it's only ever seen as, oh, it was just an excuse, there was no legitimate reason to throw Bill Clinton out of office, despite the fact you can name other problems with his administration which were far more serious than that. So I mean, isn't that just the cost of doing business almost, if you're going to pursue impeachment?
What I think is also kind of interesting and becoming quite indicative. I think that we all have to kind of be Donald Trump experts more than politics experts in order to really understand any of this.
Right.
And one of the major narratives that seems to be coming out of the Trump presidency is his focus on loyalty. And so apparently James Comey refused to do a kind of pledge of allegiance to Trump. And that is one of the reasons why he was shown the door. And that begs the question, are there other kind of parties from like politically independent bodies in DC that are also being told to pledge their allegiance and loyalty to Donald Trump? Trump also tweeted after James Comey got fired, he tweeted, James Comey better hope there's no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press. So there's a very clear fear here of Comey now having, he's not tied to the FBI, of him perhaps having a role in shaping public opinion and telling people, maybe not telling people what's going on behind the scenes, but telling people where to look. And you see this kind of panicked Donald Trump tweet come out of it.
Yeah, that's really, really weird, because it draws explicit comparison with Nixon, who famously taped his some of his conversations, and that helped his impeachment case.
Yeah, because I think that's illegal to tape somebody without their knowledge in the US.
Not in the US, I don't think.
Oh, is it not?
No,
in
I think
the US?
That's okay. I think that's generally pretty legal.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't
know. says the journalist.
Don't know what you mean by that.
Do you think that there are any links between, or how valid are the links between Watergate and what happened with the firing of Comey? Do you think that this is a Saturday night massacre again, or are people getting a bit excited?
I think it's very easy for people to get overexcited in a modern social media age, because particularly when you've got a president that tweets all hours of the day and night, slightly randomly.
entirely randomly, I would have said.
I get notifications whenever Donald Trump tweets, and he yesterday tweeted just the word "we," but then it was promptly deleted. But I still got a notification, and I'm like, I'm so happy I signed up for this. It's brilliant.
But so I think that it's very easy to make more to draw parallels and draw up links when perhaps they're not as strong as people would like them to be.
So in what way would you say they're not that strong?
Well, in that we've got Comey being fired by Trump, but what do we have any evidence of a wider issue going on here?
Right. And the wider issue is that there were prominent links between the Russian government and Trump's campaign. Right.
Although the investigation technically isn't of Trump himself, it's just of his campaign,
right, okay,
which is a very important
distinction.
Yeah.
And I think there's an element to which certainly the FBI should be allowed to get on with that investigation and to do so without being jumped on in any sense. But equally, given the checks and balances in the US, I don't really see how firing Comey changes that, because the investigation is still going to be ongoing. There's not going to be a new FBI director that says, oh, we'll shut that down.
Comey has been a really divisive figure amongst both Republicans and Democrats, because he had the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, which was cleared, but he ended up actually making it quite a political statement by saying that she should have known better, and then reopening the case only a few days before the actual election itself. And then obviously also the fact that he started the investigation into the Trump campaign, which is obviously the one that is ongoing and is being suggested as the reason for this firing. So he personally isn't hugely popular politically, but apparently within the FBI he's got lots of people are Comeyites, and he does seem like somebody who is I've read a lot of profiles on him, and he seems like somebody who really believes in the FBI as an institution, and that the people that have ended up being surrounded that have ended up surrounding him in the FBI have very similar opinions of how the FBI should work, and are really kind of like on his side. So the chances of this kind of squashing the investigation into the Russians and the links with the Trump campaign, I think is quite low. But this is so clearly, to me, attempted intimidation of people who are investigating on behalf of the FBI this particular case.
Yeah, I would definitely say that's the case. Have we said everything we need to say about this?
This isn't normal. I just want to remind everyone.
It feels increasingly normal, though.
Isn't that terrifying? Because I got the BBC notifications, like the head of the FBI has just been fired, and I was like, oh, fine.
Yeah.
But then thought about it a little bit, and then got physically panicked.
It's pretty shocking to have such an openly corrupt president in the US.
Allegedly.
It's not even alleged at this point, is it, really? I mean, his whole, failure to divest his business interests and all of that thing, he's just openly corrupt.
No, it's a blind trust that his sons are running.
Yeah. It's shocking to me that, like, that's something
that
you can just
What do you want from the man, Jimmy?
I don't know. I just can't, I couldn't see this sort of thing happening in the UK, but maybe that's a mistake to think along those lines.
I actually have one final question. Do you think that he's going to make it to the end of this term, to 2020?
I did a kind of prediction piece on the website around this, and
Lightsonable.com.
That's the one. And just based around the fact that pretty much like the overwhelming majority of presidents that actually finish their first term, it's really rare for presidents not to in the past, and that's usually a good metric of working out how likely something is to happen in the future, just taking like a broad trend. I think it was only like 15% of presidents failed to finish their first term, and 8 of those either died or were killed. It's not impossible that he would be killed, but...
he's also quite old.
He's quite old, but he's super rich and has access to the best healthcare in the world.
But does drink an awful lot of Coke.
But he's a teetotaler as well, so, you know, there's...
Balance is out.
Yeah, but on balance, I reckon he'll probably last the first term. So,
yeah,
that's the prediction.
I still think that at some point he gets bored.
And just resigns in a fit of pique.
I mean, he's clearly... something else that I think is really interesting about this and like becoming experts in Trump rather than the political institutions that surround him is the fact that he is so swayed by what he perceives as public opinion. Not public opinion done by pollsters that is actually quantifiable, but the public opinion that he ends up seeing on television and satellite news. And if I were somebody running a satellite news organisation at the moment, I would be ecstatic at the amount of influence I have over the most powerful man in the world. I wonder how they are dealing with that, knowing that Donald Trump is actually watching them all the time. Like, I'd just be like, hey, Donald, how's it going? And then just go on to do the rest of the news.
But I think they've had an outsized influence anyway. They kind of have the same role as tabloids do in the UK. They're like the main organs of public opinion as far as the press goes, as far as the media goes.
There were lots of things before the election that said that opinion run by... Like, they set the stories of the day on cable news and TV in the US. But in terms of their influence, that was seen as something that was going down, and now you see like a big resurgence there, and I think that that's something to keep our eye out on. Also, Trump has made Twitter relevant again.
But not profitable.
But no. I mean, that's never.
Goes without saying. All right, should we move on to Labour?
Oh, you mean we're not going to talk about the Eurovision Song Contest and the fact that
So, Mark, you don't buy the idea that Labour's manifesto is going to take us back to the 1970s, so what decade would you put it at?
You troll.
Well, some of the chatter on Twitter was that I think there was a Daily Stump article, Daily Mash article, or something that said the Tories wanted, or the Daily Mail wanted to take us back to the 1950s, that the 70s wasn't far back enough.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an element to it, Yeah. Clearly, you know, UKIP want to take us back to the 1850s and Tories back to the 1950s and Labour to the 70s maybe is right. Clearly, part of the future, that's why you should be but we'll come to that later.
It seemed broadly to me, even though I'm by no means a Labour voter, that it was actually quite a reasonable manifesto. Nothing in there seemed to be too out there. The defence policy, for instance, was fairly normally, despite Corbyn's general background on that sort of thing.
Want to scrap Trident anymore.
Yeah.
Which he's been dragged over the coals for, like, incessantly in the past couple of years. But it seems reasonable. Like, he's made compromises.
So are there any kind of stand-up policies that you noticed that you thought were either particularly good or particularly bad? This is for either of you, by the way.
No, I mean, I thought, as you say, I think the defence policy was interesting in that it was fairly straightforward.
Yeah, keep trying and, I don't know, there was some...
Yeah. There wasn't anything that was outright. I can't remember the details exactly.
Maintain the 2% defence spending for NATO. Mm-hmm. That was also fairly in line with Western norms, really.
The one that everyone was talking about in terms of taking it back to the 70s was the rail nationalisation.
Right, yeah. And also the Royal Mail nationalisation.
And Royal Mail nationalisation.
Do you have a particular stance on nationalisation, per se?
Not particularly. I mean, it's one of those things that I think you need to understand what it is that's happening in a particular sector.
Right.
So if you can genuinely get competition working, then that will tend to be better than a nationalised service. Mm-hmm. The difficulty with the way that the rail privatisation has worked is you have these disparate groups that can't really compete against one another. Mm-hmm. In that, so you've got, you know, obviously you've got National Rail, which run the stations on the tracks who are nationalised, and then you've got the different franchises running services on particular lines. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, if I want to go from London to Manchester, I'm going from London to Manchester. It's not like, oh, I've got a choice, I'll go to Newcastle instead. Because
I'd almost quite like it if there were a choice of, would it be a carrier? A choice of like company to ride with, and then you could have like the really cheap grotty one, which I would take every time, and like the plush one that runs on time all the time. Like that would be real.
It would be a sensible competition, and then yeah.
I mean, but would that be possible though? Because they're all using the same rails at the end of the day.
But yeah, but they end up leasing the. They don't own the rails anyway. Like they lease the rails off of like that's still technically owned by National Rail.
Right.
So the infrastructure should be nationally owned because having duplicate infrastructure seems. Uncompetitive, you know, kind of having more. It's inefficient.
Japan have it.
To have it.
But it is a shit show.
it's one of those things that I think that the railways clearly need something to be done differently, mm-hmm. Rather than the privatisation way that we've done it. But I don't think that the nationalisation approach is the right one.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. What's your view on all of this?
I have been incredibly consistent with my views on railways over the years, Jimmy.
Yeah. We've only been going for 2 years.
I hope you'll agree. Over the many years that we've been doing this podcast, I think that publicly owned companies and franchises, like, for example, TfL, should be allowed to bid on the running of these rail services. Which then gives it a chance. Like if the government fucks up, they lose the contract, and a private company can come in and run it better. But if you are able to have a publicly owned company being able to mm-hmm. run the franchise, then they can reinvest the profits into making the service better, upgrading the rail stock, making sure that there's enough carriages and seats, all of that basic kind of stuff. That just doesn't exist, especially if you're commuting into London. Mm-hmm. And that is based on, like, I'm on a particularly bad line. I'm on the Abellio Greater Anglia, or I grew up on the Abellio Greater Anglia line out east, which is, like, appalling.
Shocking.
Yeah, no, like, it's fucking terrible. And it cost me, like, 25 quid to get to work and back home every single day. Every single day. And so I've been burned by it, Jimmy, and I just won't forget it. But yeah, that's how I think that to bring it back to Corbyn and not the Jazza Manifesto for 2017, I think that broadly it's an overly simplistic solution to what actually is quite complicated, because you have a lot of private companies that still have contracts that are going to last well into the 2020s, some of them into the 2030s. But I think that it is... like I broadly land on his side of the spectrum.
I mean, I think there was polling after the manifesto was released, which said that the majority of the British public support nationalisation of the rail services, but it seems like a very tribal argument. As in, people don't go into the nitty gritty of actually managing these services. It's like you're either a Tory and you're pro privatisation, or you're Labour and you're pro nationalisation.
But then you do get the horror stories of the 1970s, like people are saying that Corbyn is taking us back to the 1970s, and. Obviously, was not alive, but it was a time of huge kind of like discord in terms of how the country ran. And bringing up those memories, especially for people of my parents and my grandparents' generation, is incredibly powerful, because like rubbish wasn't collected, trains just didn't run, or almost kind of like Southern Rail.
Freedom Week as well.
Yeah, it was blackouts like all of the time. My dad actually said that he quite enjoyed it because he was a kid at the time and liked having candles instead of lights. But that's by the by.
On a different point from the rails, Corbyn, well, the Labour manifesto suggested that they'd put together a national care service, kind of modelled on the NHS, but for social care. And a lot of people have said that the lack of social care provision has heaped more burdens on the NHS and has made it harder to run, so surely this is a good idea to have something similar.
Yeah, I think that social care and healthcare should probably be separated, run separately and funded separately, because I think that the Otherwise, you end up having regular sick people competing for hospital beds with like old people who really just need to be cared for at home if possible.
I thought the suggestion was, though, not in this manifesto, but generally that social care and healthcare should be more integrated so that you don't have people moving, people who really need social care going into an A&E, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is the one of the big issues that you have is that you have people who are looked after, you know, elderly people normally, but people who are looked after in the community who have been in hospital because they happen to have fallen and broken a hip or had an operation or whatever, and then can't be, and then effectively bed block because entirely nothing to do, not their own fault, but because
there is... Never heard the phrase bed block before.
and that because there is nowhere for them to go to in the local social care environment, and they can't be released home because they're not well enough to do that. So you end up having a massively inefficient use of resources in terms of people there when they could be in other places. So the integration of healthcare and social care is desperately needed, in my view. But it's kind of how you do that integration and how you fund it. And the real issue with social care at the moment is that it is fundamentally funded by local councils. And with local councils being slashed to the bone in terms of their funding models, that's one of the impacts that's had, and that's pushed stuff, that kind of impact in the local council area has then pushed people into the NHS, which has then caused issues there.
I will say that is actually what I meant.
Oh.
So what I mean is, social care not being dealt with via the NHS.
Right, yeah.
And therefore bed blocking. Which is something I'm going to really enjoy saying from now on.
Bed blocking. I mean, there's more stuff in here about sort of hiking corporation tax. There's the income tax for people earning above 80k, and there's also stuff around worker protections, particularly for the gig economy. I don't wonder if the danger here is not that all of these ideas are bad, but actually that Corbyn's general reputation is going to obscure quite a lot of what's in the actual manifesto.
You know what? All of those things, especially workers' rights for people who are on non-permanent contracts and in like the quote-unquote gig economy, I think that those, like, that's where workers' rights really needs to be progressed in some way, shape, or form. And in a way that is in tandem with the companies that rely on that kind of flexible work in order to function. And finding that balance is going to be very, very important in the coming years. Because it's actually how an increasing number of especially young people work and earn their livings and end up paying taxes. The problem is, as soon as you end up talking about something that looks and sounds maybe a little bit like unionisation, the Tories go,
Is stuff in here about strengthening workers' rights to unionise and that sort of thing.
Although the problem with unions, I think, isn't the lack of their powers, but the fact that their membership is so low, and therefore are not actually very representative of the people that they're meant to represent.
Sure.
I think that's the issue with unions rather than what is in here.
Do you see any future for unions, given the kind of changing nature of work?
I think there's a future for something that looks like a union, but I think the unions need to change in order to do that. And they are even... It seems to me that the union structures are even more monolithic and resistant to change than the Labour Party in some ways. In that they're very much structured in a world where you... worked for the same company for 40 years and there were hundreds of you all working in the same country, and you have your union rep who looked after you all, and when he did a good job got pushed to be the MP for the local area. And that was kind of the way that they structured, and the connection that the unions have with the Labour Party actually I think is a massive detriment to the unions, because it means that there are an awful lot of people who kind of go, well, I've probably ought to join a union at some point. I could do with some help with this, but I don't want to don't want to feel like I'm supporting
the Labour Party.
And I've met people that I know that are in that situation, and if they were willing to break that link and to work a union structure that worked much more with young people, with the gig economy, with elements of, well, actually, what does work look like for 20, 30-year-olds now? Mm-hmm. We know that you're not going to be working for the same company for 40 years. We know that quite often you won't work in the same company for the same year. Mm-hmm. And actually, I know a lot of people that like working for two or three different people at the same time, and kind of having that much more flexibility. But what that means in terms of workers' rights is still unknown in some ways, and just trying to make sure that you can strengthen that in a way that works for the workers as well as for the companies.
I mean, bearing in mind the contents of this manifesto that have yet to be finalised, and also Jeremy Corbyn's general kind of progress is probably the wrong word, but tenure over the past 2 years. What do you think the prospects are for Labour in this election?
Really great, like
slim to nothing.
Slim to nothing.
No, I don't. I struggle to see. I mean, because it's a, you know, whatever the manifesto says, even if it could be really popular everywhere, but there's a credibility issue. You know, it's no point having someone that promises something if you don't believe that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, the defence policy is fairly sane in the manifesto, but I just don't find it plausible that Corbyn would implement that kind of policy if he was Prime Minister.
Yeah, just put, they've put up whatever that, like something that's actually really, really popular and actually, like, a good manifesto that we've seen through polling most people actually agree with.
They agree with a lot of it.
Yeah, including like the scrapping of student fees for higher education, lowering the voting age to 16, all that kind of stuff, nationalising of the energy companies, or partial nationalisation thereof. But like, they don't have to worry about ever implementing any of this because they're not going to win, and so he's just put a really lovely shiny manifesto. Which is why, actually, I'm curious about the Trident thing. Because he could have put whatever he wanted. But the fact is that he is a minority view within the Labour Party still, even amongst his allies. And so probably wasn't able to waver on that.
I think we should probably turn to the Pirate Party. You sort of tried to summarise the origins of your party earlier, but in terms of the 2017 election specifically, what sort of things are you guys campaigning on?
So we've got kind of three big focuses in this election. There's an element of anti-government blanket mass surveillance.
Okay.
Trying to be really clear that that's something that we would be against, that we would repeal, that we would...
So Theresa May actually pushed through the Snoopers Charter, was it sometime earlier this year?
Yes.
And there wasn't a lot of coverage around it.
There was very little coverage. It was pushed through in a bit of a hurry, with very little fanfare, very little discussion. But that's something that we've consistently been opposed to and consistently against. There's two reasons. You know, one is a fundamental civil liberties perspective that we don't believe that every email you send, every Facebook like that you click on should be monitored, should be viewed, should be able to be seen. The personal privacy element of being able to communicate with people and the freedom to communicate is an inalienable human right, and that privacy shouldn't go away. Equally, on the other side, is the fact that it doesn't do what it's meant to do. So the argument for the mass surveillance is, war on terror, we must know what everyone's doing so that we can investigate it. But actually, if you had a targeted surveillance approach, that would work far more effectively. It is no use, the analogy I like to use is that if you're looking for a needle in a haystack, adding a lot more hay doesn't really help you. And we've seen that with a specific example. So in the Charlie Hebdo event in France. France actually has some element of a mass surveillance regime, and they had previously identified the perpetrators as being of potential interest, but there were so many other false leads that came out of mass surveillance that they dropped the targeted ones in favour of looking at it, because you can't do everything.
So it's a targeted sort of digital surveillance. Is that similar to kind of wiretapping, but for computers? How does that actually work?
So the way I would look at it would be that you need to get a warrant. In the same way that, you know, if and there needs to be sufficient evidence for that to be, you know,
proportionate.
Yeah. And at that point, in the same way that, you know, the police can, if there's sufficient justification, can come and search your house, they should be able to come and, you know, search your, you know, intercept your communications mm-hmm. on a specific line with your ISP. And that, now equally, we know that that's realistically not going to work very well, because if they, if you actually wanted to, you would just encrypt everything.
Mm-hmm. So what's your solution? What's your solution then?
There isn't really a solution to that, because you'd do that anyway.
Okay.
So what we have to understand in this world is that if you want to communicate in secret with someone, you can't undo maths.
Mm-hmm.
That ability is always is there. So just making it illegal to send an encrypted email won't stop the person that is planning something bad anyway, because getting caught for that is a pretty minor thing relative to what they're planning anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet it has massive knock-on implications for the rest of us.
So you think targeted surveillance is better, but you also don't think that it's going to eliminate the risk? It's better than mass surveillance, I mean.
I think it's better than mass surveillance because it's far more proportionate and far more mm-hmm. you know, reasonable for...
What is kind of like your, because you like you're very right in on nobody in the public really seems to care about this. What is your kind of like retort for people who are like, oh, I have nothing to hide, so I shouldn't really worry about it?
Can you please give me your bank account details?
No.
I mean, that's, I'm being slightly facetious, but there's an element mm-hmm. to which we all have something to hide.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's like one of the things that I found really frustrating about the Snoop's chart is that it this information ends up getting saved somewhere.
Hmm.
And by the fact that that information is saved somewhere, it can be hacked into and released.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a chance, like this happens quite a lot. We saw it with the NHS this week. Mm. But kind of like that idea that you aren't going to be affected by this policy because you aren't somebody who's committing terrorist acts is a bit of a fallacy.
It's a total fallacy.
I find really frustrating. Mm.
I mean, the anti-surveillance thing is the first of like your main free platforms.
Hit us with the other two problems. Go on.
Yeah.
So the other one is that kind of fundamentally comes from the pirate background mm-hmm. is copyright and patent reform.
Okay.
So we believe that actually knowledge, you know, people, we should be free to share knowledge, to share culture mm-hmm. with one another, and that society improves if you do that. We would, you know, specifically, we'd look to change copyright legislation and bring the copyright term down to 10 years.
Okay, what is it currently?
70 or quite sometimes death plus 70.
Okay.
Which is...
It's a lot.
That's Walt Disney, right? And they managed
yes,
to get
Walt
away
Disney managed. Basically, Disney managed to every 10 years go, "Oh, Mickey Mouse is about to go out of copyright. We better push it the copyright law back another mm-hmm. 10-20 years." And actually, so you see it in the, you know, in the cultural space with, you know, the likes of Disney
mm-hmm.
arguing for it, but copyright actually affects academia far more in a much more hidden way.
Okay.
In that you have journal publishers take on the copyright of academic work, and it means that it's really hard sometimes for you as an academic in a particular area to know what the most up-to-date research is in any particular branch. Is your university going to subscribe to all five journals mm-hmm. at some extortionate cost?
Mm.
And why should that?
Because so there's stuff like big data products like Google Scholar is really good at aggregating all of this information, but it's still there end up being really big gaps in especially particular parts of academia that tend to get lots of private funding.
Yeah.
Would you also enter into like the private funded space and kind of want to remove any kind of protections that they have for academic research there?
So we have, you know, have a policy that any publicly funded research should be fully open
mm-hmm.
And open to everyone, regardless of how that's done. So that's anything publicly funded in universities or what have you. The privately funded space is obviously slightly trickier. There's a recognition that you have to kind of, you know, you can't force a private company to release something that they've been doing internally. And if they are releasing something, so I think, you know, you, what you'd look to do is if they're, if it's a private company that is releasing research in a particular area, then they they should be releasing the data behind that, and that's important for knowledge,
review,
for peer review,
and
what have you.
If you're arguing, though, that in sort of the intellectual property laws as it currently stands stifle kind of further research and eventually technology innovation, that sort of thing, isn't, don't people who support intellectual property rules say the opposite, that they actually incentivize innovation because you know that you're, if you put in the money to do R&D, you're going to get the benefit because you can commercially exploit it.
That's the argument that's made.
Right.
The evidence doesn't support that. There was an interesting paper done by the St. Louis Fed, actually, a few years ago, which, you know, it was looking at patents in particular. But the idea that patents are used to kind of, you know, keep that intellectual property is a lovely one. But actually, what tends to happen is that people patent any vague thing, and then someone else comes up with an idea, and they go, oh, that's sufficiently linked to mine, I'll just nick the money off that.
Okay.
Which reduces the incentive to actually design new stuff and come up with new ideas. It just is an incentive to patent hoard.
Right, okay.
How does this work on like an international level?
With difficulty, totally.
Because also that. It's interesting talking about like the public and private thing, because when you kind of transfer that model over to the United States, where the majority of their educational institutions are
private.
Privately run, and even to a certain extent with like doctoral research and stuff, they own the rights to that research rather than the actual researcher a lot of the time. And so do you think that there's a chance, if you're going to be putting in a policy like this that allows for the sharing of people's research publicly without paywalls, do you think that that reduces the value of British research on the international stage?
I would actually say the opposite. It would incentivize, it potentially, well, it depends what you're thinking about. Because if I'm an academic, then actually coming somewhere where I have access to other British research, you know, to making that free and being part of a culture that incentivizes that and work, that collaborative sharing culture, potentially has huge attractions. Yes, might it mean that I'm less able to exploit that commercially, potentially, but that's not really why academics are in academia most of the time. And in fact, we've seen, you know, there are really good examples in the UK of academics taking ideas worked at it, university, and exploiting that commercially, even whilst those ideas being publicly available, because they've got a particular concept of how that works. And the one that I know particularly well, so the University of Cambridge and Silicon Fen have really in-depth links of working between the university and the technology companies that are there. And you've seen the great things that come out of that. I mean, Arm, autonomy, to name just a couple of, of examples.
So anti-surveillance, copyright reform, what's the third prong?
Open government being informed voters. So the concept that we all have a right to know what government is doing, that we should be able to understand that, that we should be free to do that. So that kind of hits a number of areas. There's an element of, we would push further the Freedom of Information Act to apply more widely, so that just because if you're a private company that's contracted to do stuff in a particular area for a council or for the government, that break, or in which is quite often an artificial break, shouldn't indemnify you against freedom of information, so that you get to, you know, so you can see what's actually going on,
right,
in, you know, for when, you know, people are running a prison, and you should be able to understand what's actually going on there.
Yeah.
That type of infrastructure often ends up costing governments an awful lot of money. just because of the manpower that it takes to respond to freedom of information requests and that kind of stuff. How can you justify that when quite a lot of the time, especially on local government level, it maybe isn't seen as some stuff that's hugely important to be recorded and to have the same infrastructures that happen on the big national government level?
Because if people were... It's one of the things that you... People get very afraid of technology and afraid of being able to use this stuff. And actually, if you do it right, it can be very easy to do. Mm-hmm. So you'd almost... We'd actually build up the government digital service to create open source, open platform templates for councils to use to do this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, you wouldn't actually ever need any Freedom of Information Act to say, go and give me this information. That information should be publicly available to just go and look at.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, local council level, you've got 200 odd councils across the country that do things their own different way rather than using a centralised government service to do that.
Mm-hmm. On
how they do that.
On the national level, where do you draw the line? Because there's obviously certain things that a government... So were the pirates the government in a couple of weeks? No, it's probably not going to happen.
Only running 10 candidates.
Below Jeremy Corbyn, I think. But where do you draw the line in terms of the kind of protection of information of what the government is doing? So obviously on stuff like international relations, often a lot of these things are done behind closed doors. Stuff like our intelligence services, MI5, MI6 and GCHQ. Where is that line? Those are the extremes, but obviously there's an awful lot of grey in between, like the Trident project and plans for, I don't know, infrastructure spending, blah, 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 blah. Where is the line that says, this is no longer going to be public information?
I'm not sure there would be one. I'm not sure why.
So you think James Bond is up to next week? The hypothetical James Bond.
I was going to say, on the trade negotiations aspect, one of the things that we were really aware of was looking at the... is that trade negotiations should be open because we should know that they're in the public interest and not in the interest of the corporations that happen to be lobbying.
Mm-hmm.
How do we... So that, if you have that open awareness of what's going on in a negotiation, then you can't kind of play off each other.
But when you are negotiating, you kind of need there to be at least a space of, this is just between us. Do you not think, in order to be able to negotiate effectively, without there being the prying eyes of the press? Because otherwise, press would be allowed in everywhere, right?
Mm. But we have that in our justice system and in all loads of other facets, and it just seems to be an accepted line that trade negotiators trot out that we need this privacy, but it doesn't seem to me that that's proven at all.
Mm.
Sorry to answer the question for you.
Thank you. Yanis Varoufakis, who was the economy minister of Greece, but isn't anymore and now does book tours in the UK quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the world. He quite famously used to record all of the meetings that he had with the European Commission because nobody took minutes there. And so he was like, well, I need some evidence of what happened. And so he just stuck his phone on the table and recorded the whole thing. But then I think that, I don't know, I'm on the fence when it comes to stuff like trade negotiations. And obviously there isn't evidence because we don't...
I guess it's kind of a judgment thing. But
yeah.
I don't know if anyone's done a vaguely quantifiable study of that sort of thing. I don't even know if you could.
I'm not even sure.
That's a massive thesis for someone, isn't it?
It seems like the surveillance question is a lot harder. Because if you look at things like, say, the WikiLeaks kind of dumping of documents, that was one of the main criticisms against them, is that they'd endangered the lives of agents and their affiliates operating in the field. So you surely can't believe that intelligence gathering and that sort of thing can be done in an entirely open way.
No, that's fair. Certainly there's some element...
answer.
There's some element of what the intelligence services are doing that has to remain secret. I think it's a lot further away than the line that we currently have.
Right.
And I think it should be... we should be much more, we should have more information about what is happening or what has happened recently in a, in an ability to review afterwards,
right, yeah.
way. When, you know, at the point that the agent is no longer there, we should probably be aware that, be able to find out what they were doing or
sure,
what have
sure.
you, when it doesn't pose that, that danger. That judgment call, yes, clearly would have to come there. But, you know, the security services are doing a lot of things that we feel uncomfortable about. We, you know, we, you know, part of the element of open government is supporting whistleblowers. And supporting kind of, well, when government's doing stuff that is not in the public interest, but they're still doing it, when mm-hmm. they're breaching their remit, how do we know about that? And you know, it's one of the things that we would really support Edward Snowden, mm-hmm. for example, and kind of saying, look, actually, the NSA and GCHQ are doing this.
One final question before we wrap up. Where does the Pirate Party stand on Brexit? Because it is the defining issue of this election.
It shouldn't be the defining issue of this election, but...
Yeah, I know, mate, but...
I get that. So we had... we don't have a particular stance on Brexit. We have a free... You know, a free vote within the party. You know, anyone could mm-hmm. vote
yeah.
however they chose.
Is the party so, in general... Does it tilt Eurosceptic or...
Europhile?
It would... prior to the election, it would... I would say it tilted Europhile, mm-hmm. Probably tilted towards Remain, in conjunction with it being predominantly, you know, we're a far younger party mm-hmm. than the majority.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to, you know, we err on that side. We tend to err towards the more international set of people. Mm-hmm. You know, if you communicate digitally, you tend to be more engaged mm-hmm. overseas. And we tend to have more people that are along with the young element that are educated to degree level or above.
Right.
So...
Are you saying that stupid people voted Brexit?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that if you look at those demographics, even if, regardless of being members, being related to the Pirate Party, those demographics would tend to mm-hmm. lead to a...
Mm-hmm. Well, say...
To a Remain.
If you're in a position where you could, say, call a referendum once the negotiations are done, or actually, you know, potentially block Brexit or whatever, what mm-hmm. would your party's stance be on that sort of thing?
That's an interesting one. I don't think the party would have a stance on that particularly. I think it's one of those things that different people in the party would take different views.
Mm-hmm. What's your view then?
Personally... I think that that's something that Parliament should review, but not a referendum again.
Okay.
I think I really struggle with the concept of we have a democracy saying, because that strikes me as very much the Lib Dem approach of, well, we want a referendum to change this because we didn't like the result we got the first time around.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of have a bit of an issue with that from a democratic perspective.
Okay, so you wouldn't be out to block Brexit, but you might want to review the exit terms.
Yes.
In a parliamentary context.
In a parliamentary context. And I would fight very strongly for things in exit terms that matter to us, that kind of making sure that, you know, so it's a party of freedom, so we'd look for you know, be encouraging free movement. We'd very much, you know, I really like, you know, some of the things that we do with the EU, the Erasmus scheme, for example, that transfer of knowledge of students from one place to another is something that I would really... be encouraging us to remain part of, even as you step outside of Europe, and that's something that we should be looking to.
Okay.
To do.
Awesome. Thank you so.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Nothing.
All right. Shall we wrap this up then?
Yes.
Where can people find you on the internet if they want to tweet at you or contact you? Or...
So you can tweet the party on @PiratePartyUK. You can tweet me personally @Pirate_Lennon. And
Lennon as in John Lennon.
Lennon as in John Lennon.
Yeah.
Rather than Lenin.
Yes. Rather than Lenin. Yes, just to be clear. Sorry. Yeah. LENNON.
Where can they find out about your campaign?
We are on the website pirateparty.org.uk or come to chat to us on our Discord server, is where we tend to have lots of people come and join us.
Oh,
Discord.pirateparty.org.uk.
Amazing. We don't have a Discord, but you can find us on Twitter @RightDishonor. Leave us a review. On the internet,
on iTunes.
Also, the stars. You can leave stars for every single episode.
Wow.
Did you know that? fun. you can find me at Jazza John, and also on the internet as Rhyming with Oranges, where I make videos and I'm like, it's funny. And Jimmy writes things.
Yes, you can find me at JDE Nichols on Twitter, but I don't have a YouTube channel. Sorry.
Anymore.
Anymore.
I want to dig it up and show it to everybody. We'll have a viewing party at some point. anyway, see you next week. Toodaloo.